Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Hey, everyone. It's Asten Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Hey. Come here for a second. Yeah, just for a sec. Welcome to the New York Times podcast. Your gorgeous, gorgeous boys take a week off. Gorgeous, gorgeous boys and girls. I have a little gift for you of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. As you can probably tell, this is an episode about Lana. We recorded this episode, me, Lindsay, Mina, and Pedro. Recorded this episode back around chemtrails and had a little bit of an issue with the file. And it's been on my mind these past few months. I wanted to find a way to hopefully rescue it and get it back. Fortunately, as a year beginning treat, Pedro was able to rescue the file from the maw of technical difficulties. And here we go. I want to say it was a great episode. It's one that I thought about a lot over the course of the year. So I'm really, really happy that we're able to do this. And I hope you guys dig it. So look, we're just going to jump right into it. Here is me, Lindsay Zolads, Mina Tavakoli, talking about Lana Del Rey. Listen to Happy New Year. White stripes when they were white hot. Listening to rock all day. I'm joined. Lindsay Zolads is here. Lindsay, hello.
Hi.
Lindsay reviewed the new Lana Del Rey album for the New York Times. Joining us also for the first time, Mina Tavakoli is here. Mina.
What's up?
Mina reviewed the album for Pitchfork. We are going to be talking about Lana, which means we are going to be talking about American conservatism or iconography or the tug of war of willpower. I don't know what we're going to be talking about. We're going to be talking about California and leaving California. Actually, just a quick sidebar to the two people who emailed me separately about our Grammys episode, informing me that both Black Pumas and Her are played on the radio in California. I want to say to you that I appreciate you underscoring my New York-centric understanding of radio programming, and also want to acknowledge that that is a strange thing. So thank you for sharing with me. It remains strange. While we were in California, back to Lana Del Rey, Chemtrails over the Country Club. It's newly out. We have the authors of the two definitive reviews. Mina, let's kick it off with you. Can you talk a little bit about this album, especially in context of Norman Rockwell? Because to me, at least, they feel like, if not exactly of a piece, we're in a similar era to me in my year. But I wonder if you could talk about where they sit together and also in the bigger picture of Lana.
I think it might be beneficial to begin maybe at the beginning. We don't have to do this elaborately. We can start, you know, with the tale as old as time. Actually, it probably begins in like 1950, which is sort of blended with 2011. This woman named Lana Del Rey came out with a pop album that for so many was sort of out of nowhere, ex nihilo. And it was this singular, strange document that blended together so much American detritus and a really specific style of American detritus. There was this image bank sort of yanked from an America that exists only in symbols and signs, you know, Gatsby, sugar daddies, cherry pies, Marilyn Monroe. She revered a lot of things that I think a lot of people consider flat, ridiculous, or sort of like worn down by time.
And speaking of that era, Mina is going to take me to the red table later in this episode about 2012, although 2011 and 2012. So I'm looking forward to that. but please talk more about these shop-worn symbols of a decayed and yet still glorious American history.
I think both you and Lindsay did excellent reviews of Born to Die when it came out.
I honestly had not read that in years. I was really grateful for the opportunity to revisit it. It was like I was hopped up on Frosted Flakes when I was reading it. And it's honestly how I thought. I was like, damn, like, let's go. Like, this is like, yeah, like, what's 2011 memes? Yes. Anyway, we'll come back to it. Please continue.
I feel like whenever I reread my old pieces, I feel like the healthy attitude is just light disgust.
Right, but I've been doing this a long time. I've worked that both out of my system, and also it is in my system so irretrievably that like it's just there always. I don't acknowledge it. I just know it's there.
Yeah, it's easy to sort of press those memories down. But speaking of memories, we're talking about Lana, her sort of aesthetic lodestars. You know, they're not just idiosyncratic for a pop star to have, but they're sort of pretty strict. The year Ultraviolence came out, her second album, the now defunct website Tiny Mixtapes published a literal index along her second album with a sort of audit of all of the tropes and themes and the words that she sort of cycles and recycles.
Oh, wow. I don't remember that. Shout out Tiny Mixtapes, though. Gone too soon.
Absolutely. You know, I was thinking about this, and it's not exactly a limited imagination she has, but it's sort of an imagination that's really disciplined and very narrow, and one that she would sort of sharpen as sort of the decade continued.
Lindsay, do you find that imagination, those specific touchstones, especially dating back to the beginning of Lana's career, did you find them refreshing? Did you find them limiting? Did they seem preposterous? Did they seem an organic development of coming out of the 2000s? Like, how did they strike you upon first notice?
On first notice, very puzzling and kind of out of nowhere. Like, I think that she seemed very much like a reactionary figure with that first record, both a reaction against a certain type of like hashtag empowerment pop that was coming out of, you know, a lot of female artists at the time. This is the Teenage Dream era, which is a whole different type of American pastiche in pop, but a much more optimistic one. And I think she also was taken as a reactionary presence in the world of quote unquote indie music, which, you know, we're so far beyond even knowing what that means in 2021, but we're sort of at a time in a decade ago where that still meant something to some people. And she was kind of seen as an interloper in that world. So she was kind of getting reaction from both sides and in some ways pushing back against dominant trends in both of those worlds. The kind of indie rock world still being very male dominated at that point. Like, I think there's been a huge resurgence of female artists in the last decade, but there very much was this feeling of just like, you know, to shout out to Who Weekly, but who is this woman was kind of the dominant question. And I think another question was the extent to which irony and kind of postmodern pastiche was playing a part here. And like Mina was saying, she was bringing these touchstones back from the past, and the reaction was kind of like, is she serious? Is she messing with us? Does she really have this intimate connection to like the glamorous days of the movie stars of the 1950s and just like Elton John songs that everyone knows the lyrics to? Like, I think in one of my more cruel perhaps reviews of her album, which was my review of Honeymoon, which I did look back at and was like, but I think I called.
We're taking
called
you her, to the red table, Lindsay. Yeah, you're coming. We're all going to the red table.
Always ready to go there. But I think I had called her references Wikipedia deep, which I still kind of like stand by. But I think that over time she has refined her approach and very much doubled down on like, yes, she was serious. Yes, she was earnest to the extent that we are ever going to know the real person, Lizzie Grant, that like she has in one of her more sort of controversial statements recently, of which she's made quite a few, but really doubled down on this sense that I don't have a persona. This is who I am. And I think that at the beginning, when she first came on the scene, she was taken as someone who was all persona and still perceived that way by some people. But what she is at least telling us and has been over the last decade is that this love of these particular touchstones and these very wide swath Americana signifiers is coming from somewhere earnest and serious for her.
Okay, I want to inject one statement and then a question. So the thing that I want to say in the defense of Lana Del Rey, in the defense of Lindsay Zoladz, in the defense of Mina Tavakoli, in the defense of John Caramonica, not to get all Irving Goffman with it, but it's like we are all constructing ourselves every day. We are all playing characters. We are all inventing ourselves along the way. There may be postmodern approaches to it. There may be non-postmodern approaches to it. But fact remains, this is something that is happening with everybody. All your favorite stars, all your favorite indie artists, these are cultivated poses. Now, some are more ornate than others. Some are more ostentatious than others. Some are more troubling than others. But they are cultivations. And it's important to remember that. So that's the statement. The question, and Lindsay, you were just touching on this, and Mina, in your review, I think you sort of allude to this. Does Norman Rockwell mark the point where either you personally believe or popularly it is believed that Lana Del Rey shifts from ironist to sincere songwriter slash articulator of the American condition? Is that the turning point, or were we just not being generous enough to her earlier in her career?
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I think I'm always interested into why Norman did what it did culturally and critically. I think, you know, she did turn a corner. The mythos was sort of held at an arm's length at a place where sort of critics were less aggravated by that fabulism. And the soap operatics were so much more personal, even though she still held fast to that vision of her country. She was still shameless. You know, there were beautiful, prayerful songs about hearing of North Korean ballistic missile tests while listening to Father John Misty at Coachella. There is so much unpalatable cheese in her lyrics for so many people. It's such a proprietary blend of cheese. And I really do think it depends on your sort of stomach for the degree of camp and mixed up. I called it white American Arcana in order to sort of appreciate it.
Should we listen to a little bit of a Coachella Woodstock in my mind?
Sure.
Please.
This is pre-Norman, right?
Yeah, this is on Lust for Life. I traded all for a stairway. I take my time for the climb up to the top of it. I trade the fame and the fortune and the legend.
Lindsay, what's your vibe on the turning point? Or was there never a turning point? It was us who turned.
I think it's complicated because I still think that she doubles down on this fact that she was never an ironist and that even the songs on Born to Die are coming out of the same vein as Norman Rockwell. And I do think you're right to point to the Coachella song as like a turning point because I think Lust for Life was kind of a transitional moment for her. I think it was 2017. A record that is quite meandering and I think like half great, but really sort of a bunch of songs that she just throws against the wall. There's a lot of collaborations on it. It doesn't have a lot of like cohesion as a record, but you do get a couple of these songs and it is like her first post-Trump record where she's gesturing towards a larger world and the present moment of what is going on in America right then. And that Coachella song to me feels like a precursor to something she would do a lot better on the song The Greatest, which I think was kind of the big song from Norman and the one that seemed to really tap into something that was going on in the present moment, which again is sort of a new thing for people to look to Lana Del Rey for. I think Video Games, which to me is by far the best song from the Born to Die era and from that record, I think there was something that was tapping into like a very specific cultural thing and moment. Like that feels very tapped into its present while at the same time gesturing back to these aesthetics of the past. But I think she, on Lust for Life, the back end of it in particular, she starts looking around at 2017, at 2019, and, you know, knowing that that sort of old-fashioned aesthetic is always going to be with her and is the way in which she's chosen to compose her music, but is trying to at least say something larger about the American culture of her moment that she's living in.
Yeah, to understand that the mythos, as it were, what's happening right now can be understood in those terms. You're not limited in applying that framework simply to the events or the aesthetics of the past. And to me, maybe that's where the real power in Norman comes from, and to a slightly lesser degree on Chemtrails, where the juxtaposition of these incredibly specific today reference points rendered through the gauziness of how Lana typically treats history. That juxtaposition, I don't even want to say it's a provocation because I don't think it is. It's the expression of a fully matured worldview that no longer sees the difference between the ideology of the 50s or the 70s and the specifics of today. And that to me was a very promising shift musically in songwriting. And maybe that's Jack too. I don't know. It might be Jack giving a little space that wasn't there before. TBD.
I do think that her collaborations with Jack Antonoff are some of the strongest for both of them in these last couple of years. And I think when you listen to what I have not come around on Born to Die in this past decade. And I think what really is off about that record for me is the production. And you can hear them trying to match her with more pop producers, trying to almost place her within this like hip hop framework, which was a whole other conversation. She branded herself as the gangsta Nancy Sinatra, which, you know, launched a thousand think pieces of its own in 2011. But I think that she over time has gravitated towards figuring out the production that works best for her sound. Because again, I think something that's really interesting about the way she broke through beyond just that sort of indie and Tumblr sphere is with the remix of Summertime Sadness, not the original version as it is on her record. Like it, she basically broke through with a dance remix of this very plaintive, mournful ballad, which is kind of odd in and of itself and gave that record a really long tail. But I think there was a lot of pivoting in the beginning to figure out what production works for her. And I really like how much these last two records have leaned on piano. I think that's a really good accompaniment for the timbre of her voice. And I like a lot of the piano-driven songs, but she has also become much stronger melodically over these past two albums. There's a lot of just melody ideas, even on this record. There are bridges and little breakdowns in the songs that have really strong melodies that she almost like has melodies to burn at this point. And I don't think that was necessarily true of the first couple of records. So I see her kind of sharpening her musical sensibility as well as she's kind of getting a little bit more perhaps to say about her present moment. Although I don't know that that thread continues through on this record. I think this record has a lot less to say about the world outside of Lana Del Rey's head than Norman did by far.
You know, that first record, a lot of that record is done by Emil Haney, who had done a lot of hip hop stuff, worked with Cudi. And I think the stylistic notion of that record was make the soundtrack for the movie that she thinks she's in. or that she's writing towards. And so a lot of those touchstones felt almost period specific more than genre specific or style specific, at least in retrospect, you know, to the imagined period that she's harking back to. Whereas I do think what's happened on the last two albums, this is imperfect, but like they're inching towards dark quasi alt country. Not that they're country records, although maybe they are country records, which is a sidebar that I think if I was going to write anything about the last two Lana records, it would be about them functioning as country records. But the notion, the instrumentation reminded me kind of like early 2000s when alt country was kind of like coalescing as an idea, maybe the late 90s into the early 2000s. And I think that's a better fit for where she is lyrically and melodically right now.
I think something that's interesting about these past few records too is she basically announced the follow-up right when these records, both of them came out. She had had the title Chemtrails Over the Country Club. We knew that that was the next record since the Norman release. And she's now given us the supposed title of her next record, which is Rock Candy Sweet.
Someone on the Clubhouse chat last week suggested, it was like someone who worked at UMG or someone who, you know, had some information, said that part of the reason that Chemtrails came out now is because there was some issue with the vinyl pressing and it was supposed to come out many months before. Mina, do you think that it would have been received differently or processed differently if it had come out kind of closer to Norman? Would that have changed anything?
Perhaps. I think also because I heard hearsay here, but that it would be called not Chemtrails, but it would have been called White Hot Forever, which I think would have been a much more sizzling title and a lot more funny in every context. To the note of production, though, I do think there is something, I'm going to sound like an apologist, something like particularly charming and, you know, how the first one felt like it came out of like absolutely nowhere. And it was a bit like, you know, it was like a mixtape. The production was so all over the place. And it does feel like, you know, all innovators, there are sort of clunky at their start, and there is something abrasive, and there's a lot of friction that happens when you sort of first see these things, and you're like, back to the original question, is she serious? You know, this is unbelievable, I think was the statement.
I mean, I feel like we've got to listen to something off the record, because I feel like we're talking about it so much. What should we listen to? Should we listen to Blue Jeans, Diet Mountain Dew?
Diet Mountain Dew is going to be my, like, to me, that is the essence of that record distilled in a slime green, just highly concentrated cup of America, baby.
And as someone that drinks carbonated beverages, even I know Diet Mountain Dew is like high slime.
A violent
like,
choice. Yeah.
Yeah, that is, that's waking up and choosing violence. Ultra violence even. All right, let's listen to a little Diet Mountain Dew off of Born to Die.
This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at The New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at The New York Times work on every day to give you clarity and perspective and, above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to The New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
The last albums, I feel like, and this, you know, speaks to John's notion of her becoming sort of an alt country star in her own right. You know, they were rooted on both coasts in a way to sort of mine the glamorous signifiers associated with either. You know, you had LA for Rockwell, the Tri-State for Born to Die, California again on Honeymoon and Ultraviolence and Lust for Life. But this one sort of rambles into the country. It's warmer here. There's a lot less of the Bond style balladeering, but, you know, there's definitely a lot of Lana Pass in this. And that's what I think I like so much about it, is that there's a document that points to Lana past and Lana present. There's still plenty of the Rockwell sincerity, but we don't lose that American worship. And it's sort of deepened and sort of reconstituted into something that feels so contemporary. Like the song Chemtrails Over the Country Club. I adore this title so much. I think it's such a perfect, rich, new American fable. Are you both familiar with what chemtrails are? Is our audience familiar with what chemtrails are?
I think I would hope they are. But I have wondered that. I wondered that when I was writing my review, actually. I was going to ask my mom if she knew what chemtrails were to sort of orient myself with the New York Times readership. But I just
wait. Do you think your mom, is she going to listen to this episode? Do you think?
Who knows? If so, hi, Mom.
Hi, Lindsay, Mom. You want to give like a 7-second primer on chemtrails?
Sure. They are probably the white things that you see in the sky coming off planes that may or may not, depending on the conspiracy theories you believe online, be responsible for a number of modern ills.
They're evil. They're evil. Chemtrails, they're the evil effluvia of mass industrialization or whatever that are conspiring against our physical and psychical well-being, and maybe also left by aliens. I don't know. There are like several different iterations of it, kind of. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a psyop. It keeps us like under control, man.
And I think to Lana's purpose too,
podcast
like
podcast is a psyop.
It does seem like, of all the internet conspiracy theories, like it seems like the one that most celebrities have co-signed. Like there's a very iconic Kendall Jenner post about chemtrails, or was it Kylie? Who can say at this point? But a lot of like Gen Z celebrities have posted like, just wondering, do you ever look up in the sky? And
if it was Kylie, though, she might have then subsequently named like a shade of blush after it. Like, you know, like chemtrail blush, like dropping Friday.
Yeah, I mean, I can't confirm that she hasn't, but
that'd be beautiful. Yeah, yeah. If I was like an oat milk brand, I would totally name it like, you know, an oat milk whipped cream or something would be chemtrails or something.
Oh,
really tap into the zeitgeist.
Wow, chef's kiss.
Yeah, they are really perfect for celebrities because it's so dreamy. You know, you just look up. They don't have the sort of violence of like a vaccine where you're actually being sort of stabbed with a needle or something. Though anti-vaxxers, I know, run amok. But, okay, chemtrails over the country club. How perfect is it? You know, it's another American fantasy, and it's such a contemporary one. The dream worlds that are woven by others and by her for us, they're just so gorgeous because, like any delusion, they bring order to sort of chaotic, disorganized, complicated world.
Beautiful.
So at the beginning of the episode, we listened to White Dress, which is the first song on the album. Let's listen to Chemtrails of the Country Club, which is the title track in the second song. Is the notion of chemtrails over the country club, independent of the specific lyrics of the song, but just like the idea, is this the death of American empire? Is this those who have built up industry or built up American government are going to be the victims of their own excess? Is that what Lana's selling here?
I don't think she's taking it that far.
No.
I don't know if it's that deep, honestly. I think like she just hit on a phrase that sounded really cool and juxtaposed.
You're saying it's just a good TikTok.
It's a great TikTok. Yeah. I am almost more sus about like the country club aspect of it. I do really like that song, and I think it's one of the stronger melodic ideas she pursues on this record for sure. But, you know, there's always this kind of idea of white privilege that is the constant undercurrent of her music. And she at times seems to be consciously like playing around with that. Obviously, the idea of the country club conjures like a pretty closed off, wealthy white society. And this idea of like leisure, and even the tempo and the pace of the song is like a lot of her songs, just very leisurely, almost wanting to create this space of leisure that goes against the grain of a lot of things about our modern culture, and this nostalgia for perhaps a fictional time when there was more of that. But I'm very curious about how you guys like interpret that side of it, and if it feels as confrontational as she seems to think that some of her, as she's called them, questions for the culture, maybe. My favorite phrase of all time. Some questions.
Really,
all very I do solid. Is pose questions to the culture.
Genuinely, so. And I say this with emphasis, who can relate? Big facts. And also the sidebar to this, and to touch on what Lindsay is alluding to, with which is Lana's recent kerfuffle about articulating her own complexity and people being denying it to her, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Is there room for a popular white performer who is complicated in the ways that Lana Del Rey seeks to be allowed to be complicated in current American pop music? Is there actual space for that? It was just partially a Lana question and partially a how the universe receives these things question.
A question for the culture.
Yes.
I'll let you take that, Mina.
I like the idea, you know, the white privilege thing is totally correct, but I sort of like it better if it's like white, you know, delusion, because I think she loves, you know, living in it. There's something like not harmful about her. I don't think she is like actually something that is to be feared in any way.
But she's received as an agent of harm in all these kind of like public implosions. And I, too, am kind of a little bit like, yeah, maybe a little bit of an overread, a little bit of an overcorrection against it. But I wonder, I mean, can you talk a little bit about the not harmful thing? Because I'm interested in how someone who is perceived as being harmful potentially is not.
I think her stakes feel so personal for some reason. Her relationship to her audience and her critics, it's like both detached and like anaclitic, or like it's very codependent. It's this weird sort of blend. You know how some stars are so disinterested with interacting with the press or with other people, but it seems like she's one of the few that's willing, if not energetically, actively pursuant of engaging on that level.
And I think in some senses too, like several of her records, and I'm thinking of this one and also Ultraviolence, which just to throw a curveball here, I think is maybe my favorite Lana album still. I really ride for that one. I think both that record and this one feel reactionary against the things that were being said about her in the culture. Ultraviolence was a reaction against the Born to Die conversation. And there are songs like Brooklyn Baby, for example, amazing song title, and just lyrics that are kind of pushing back at the bloggers that had things to say about her. And this record to me, I mean, it's largely about her questioning her relationship to fame, and particularly fame in, she doesn't specify like in a modern context, but fame in the era of the Instagram questions for the culture and then being dissected and everything being filtered through this prism of meaning that I think it has been with her. Often I agree to the detriment of focusing on her music, but I think there are also fascinating questions that she brings up. The Lana timeline of the past 2 years are, to quote one of her favorite words, wild. Because 2019, Norman comes out, it is met with critical acclaim, it's on number one on like many critics' lists at the end of that year. People really think it's like capturing something about a national mood. And then 2020 happens. And specifically, all of the Black Lives Matter demonstrations happen and the protests. And suddenly, people are pointing out like, oh, Lana was dating a cop until like a month ago. And she was Instagramming from protests and not blurring out the protesters' faces in her Instagram story and getting a lot of blowback from that because they could be identified by the police. So there's this feeling that she's suddenly out of step with that sort of world that I think she was looking out into in like the Coachella song or in The Greatest, because the world has accelerated at this rate in the past year.
And she's almost, you know, this is an overstatement, but like an agent of the state. It's become this kind of, you're not with us, you're on the other team. That's sort of how the politics of that moment were playing out. Obviously, love who you love, but that's how it was received in those circles.
I think it is to this record's benefit that it comes out in 2021 and not the summer of 2020, because I do think it would have been received probably unfairly harshly and not judged as much for the music, but for the conversation that she was creating. But the record was also done at that point. So this is not necessarily a reaction against that particular moment and these questions she was posing on her Instagram that were, I think, facing some of the sharpest criticism of her since the early days of her career. I think that this record has been largely, the reviews seem mixed to kind of like meh positive, I would say. And I wonder how much of that is a reaction to the music and how much of that is a reaction to these kerfuffles that she started. And I think it's kind of both. Like, I don't think this is a record that warrants as much critical praise as Norman. I don't think it's as good or tries to swing as hard as she did on Norman. But I'm also just constantly fascinated by like the changing perception of her in the culture and the way that we evaluate her music.
You mentioned in your review, you mentioned the sort of decreased specificity in the songwriting, which I think is accurate on this record. I wonder, does that seem like a reaction against, I don't know what, in Norman or the reception? Because you would think the reception was so positive, but is it a reaction on some level? Or does it just feel like kind of the slightly lesser cousin to Norman? Like the stuff that just kind of like didn't quite hit as hard, but like here we still are.
I think the scope of this record is much smaller. And in some ways, that's good. Like, I think that Lust for Life, Honeymoon, to their detriment, are kind of meandering, don't really have like a central point that they're trying to make. And this record is like a lot leaner and clearer in what it's trying to say than those two albums. The flip side is that what it's trying to say is like, it's hard being famous and sometimes I don't want to be. And that, with the exception of like Take Care, it's really hard to make an entire record compelling on that theme.
The collaboration we didn't know we needed.
Always top of mind. But yeah, to me, that is both the kind of streamlining emphasis of this record and what makes it feel like a minor work compared to this really sweeping statement she was making on the last record. And I think she would probably agree with that too. It feels intentionally smaller and more intimate.
It is at the same time, though, like, definitely still jumbly, in as much as there are pieces that do feel like they could belong on other albums. And I think some actually literally did, you know, have intent to belong on past albums. You know, like Wild at Heart, that could be on Ultraviolence or even a very polished cut off Born to Die. There's still some whole hog Lana pieces on it that I think make it such a nice, rich portrait of, you know, the person, the portrait that she's given us off lyric and in lyric and in music.
Wanted to pick up on something we had alluded to a little bit, but like, could America handle a conservative pop star right now? And if so, is Lana that conservative pop star?
I don't think she's a pop star. I'm going to pick that bone, actually.
Oh, fine. Oh, come on.
But like, I think she's on that level. I don't consider her conservative. I don't think she would identify her politics this way, but I really liked a phrase, Mina, that you used as white delusion instead of white privilege. And I think she represents someone who maybe didn't have to think about a lot of these questions until fairly recently. I don't think she had to really consider what feminism was before the whole Born to Die conversation. And I still don't think she has a clear understanding of what it is as a political movement. In one of her Instagram notes, she is talking about how feminism needs to make space for fragility and for women who look and act like me. And the whole point of feminism is that the entire culture, that was all the only type of women who were accepted and valorized were people who performed a certain kind of fragility and looked, you know, roughly the way that she does. So I think that she sometimes is thrust in this position of having to make statements about things that she has never had to be terribly informed about. And maybe that is like a broader, more relatable thing about her to people who are like looking for someone more moderate or looking for someone who hasn't had to have a stance on all of these social issues that are suddenly really in the public discourse in a way that they hadn't been 20 years ago or something.
And but Mina, you even talk about this at the top of your review in terms of Lana talking about the need for everyone, including the Capitol rioters, to wild out. It's not a statement I can imagine Katy Perry making, you know, Taylor Swift. I just can't imagine that.
Ariana Grande.
Ariana Grande. Yeah, I just can't imagine it. You know, whether it's empathetic or skeptical or whatever, I just couldn't imagine anybody else engaging with it in that way. And I think you opening your piece with that, it was like a little bit of a chill, kind of like, huh, what's really cooking here? What's this? Where do the delusions lie?
And some part of me wonders, you know, where her PR team is, but on second or third thought, I think it actually is, quote, you know, sort of savvy in a sort of sideways way. And this is a crazy word, but kind of refreshing again in sort of a sideways way to see her like so clearly and so lucidly as this person who she's been serious all along. She has been dead serious. You know, I think there's so much to be said about like what's anticipated from a pop star or a star of her caliber and what we get. And it's not just, I think it's our version of the aughts, you know, teen queen gone wild degeneracy where they're going nuts at clubs and getting photographed by paparazzi. But she's a poster, you know, that's this online degeneracy that's really made her, for better or worse, like a very clear image of a very certain type of person. It's not menacing, but it reflects back a very certain mindset.
Do you think that mindset provides succor to people who don't find it elsewhere in contemporary popular music or pop or whatever framing? Do you think that it provides a certain kind of like wink, wink, nudge, nudge?
Maybe. Sucker is hilarious. Yeah. It's
her
like
the next album title, you know.
There is something I will say is like very inhabitable about her music. And I think it's, you know, it does make for like a certain type of stan, and it does make for a certain type of listen. You know, when you listen, you know, when you listen to White Dress, you're as white as her dress, and you know, you can become the main character of her Lana songs. And it is a lavish thing. Especially, would be curious to see what her non-white fans are like. But if I could speak personally, it is the idea of being a sort of perfect 50s angel, a sort of Shirley Temple teenager, heartbreaker, to be hot and young and bulletproof in a couple ways, but also very vulnerable in a couple of ways, is cool.
It's all vibes.
As a kid say, it's a mood.
I am sort of always shocked that there are not more kind of like aesthetic Lana TikToks. Like they would kind of like be good for aesthetic TikToks. And maybe they're out there and I just haven't encountered them. Although given that I spend 3 hours a day on TikTok, like it seems unlikely, but I'm always surprised. They would provide good, rich, very, very textured homes for that kind of thing.
I get that you have to be attentive to TikTok professionally, but I'm sorry. I don't know how you do that.
Oh, no. Come on. Wait, where are you? No, that's the wrong answer. That's not the right answer. This is the hotbed of Gen Z and post Gen Z. This is where all the action is. It's not anywhere else. This is like, it's vital. It's vibrant. It's theatrical. It's hilarious. It's provocative. It's home. These are my friends, Mina.
I want you to listen back to this later, and
I'll play it for my therapist. How about that? I'll play it for my therapist. Should we briefly go to the red table about 2011 and 2012?
I'm already there.
Wow.
I've been waiting.
Okay. So, Mina, I want to say in your review of this album, you make a reference to my piece in 2012 about the Born to Die era. Her image is a volatile wasp cosplaying as a bourgeois bohem obsessed with American kitsch. Reviews practically demanded an apology for her image, underscored, hot linked, hyperlinked to your boy right here. That's me. That was an interesting time in writing about music. And I'm curious also, Lindsay, to hear what you have to say about that moment. I remember thinking really hard at that moment about, we're not just reviewing an album, we're reviewing an unusual cultural phenomenon. We're reviewing someone who was cut from new cloth and presented whole on the internet, decontextualized. I think I refer to her as an island, or the album as an island, and trying to make sense of that process, which would ultimately become the norm or closer to the norm over the course of the 2010s. But at that time, still felt radical and desettling. And so when I was rereading this old review, I was trying to like walk a very fine line. I don't know that I always nailed it, but I feel like I was walking a fine line between trying to take stock of the internet reaction to her, which was very hostile, and also the art itself, which I did not think was deserving of that degree of hostility, but trying to take stock of that entire volatile situation. And that was a complicated moment. Lindsay, what's your recollection of that moment?
I think the Pitchfork review of that record was like probably the biggest piece I'd written up until that time, and definitely like the most high profile album review that I had done. So it was also, for me, it's really tied in this moment of, I was someone that was essentially coming out of the feminist blogosphere and into this mainstream, and at the time, even more so than now, very male dominated conversation about her. And I do think a lot of the critical voices sort of coming up in that moment that had maybe a background in looking at things through a feminist lens, or were coming out of this feminist internet, were suddenly like getting asked, like, you make sense of this. Like, what's going on here? Because anything that we, the men, say is probably going to look bad or something. I think less so than that concern would have been had today. But so I see it very intertwined with this moment of more of the mainstreaming of like talking about feminism in pop culture in the distinct way, for better or worse, that we continue to sort of look at it and define it now. So I think she was just a lightning rod for that dynamic and that shift in the critical conversation, because she brought up so many questions about what a female artist, do they have a responsibility to be a feminist, to be doing something subversive and forward thinking? Or is it always, as you said, conservative to kind of play around with ideas of submission and ideas with courting the male gaze, which I think she does on this record still. White Dress is one of my favorite songs on the record. It's a song about feeling good when men are looking at you and thinking you're hot. And she has made a lot of songs about that, which was a very naughty, like K-N-O-T-T-Y, but also, I guess, the other one too. To be talking about in public in this sort of pop feminism moment of 2012. I do really value the questions that talking about her work has brought up. And like, I still clearly am not tired of dissecting her questions for the culture. But I think in a lot of ways, she was unwittingly a lightning rod in these conversations. And the label putting her out at that time, and everyone sort of involved in that image were aware that it was gonna go there.
Okay, Mina, now you've heard our explanations of the time. Now just rinse us.
I'm certainly not on the right side of history or ever, you know, profess to be correct. But, you know, no one's ever like correct in criticism. All you can sort of hope for is like, do you appreciate and admire the sort of angles of logic that a critic will take? And, you know, what you guys both do is like, stop.
No, you stop.
I think what you both do, you know, the question you've got to ask is always like, not just what is this album or cultural object or piece of art or whatever, but more unfortunately, you have to ask like, why is this album? You know, what is it doing and saying? Where does it come from? It doesn't just sublime out of gas. I think both of you guys sort of addressed it lovingly, though. I will say you did conclude your piece, John, by telling her to, you know, wash off her face paint, muss up her hair, and try again in a few years, which I thought was raw.
Yeah, that was sometimes you can be so laden and weighed down by how you are perceived and how you are received that it can seem like the only logical response to that is to retreat. And I don't mean this for Lana specifically. I just mean this like in life. Like, and at that point, I mean, it's hard to remember. I'd say broadly speaking, that was a less toxic time on the internet. And this was an exceedingly toxic discourse in a less toxic time. I think a lot of internet discourse is very much like the Lana discourse now. It gets there very fast. And it's like everybody is both an icon and a problem. Lana's arrival happened to coincide with like the emergence of that as a novelty. And I feel like a lot of what I was trying to grapple with in that piece was, how do you maintain a true self, whatever that might be? Again, Irving Goffman aside, you know, how do you maintain a true self when people are telling you this truth is either invalid or not true at all? And like, I know that that last graph, I agree, it reads harsh. I think underneath it, a note of sympathy. That's what I think. Now, obviously, 10 years have passed. It's a lot of time. But at least when I read it now, I hear a note of sympathy under it, which is like, it's not always going to be like this. There could be another chance. But I agree. When you read it, it's like, yeah.
Criticism is always like a document of its time and place.
Yeah, it's a snapshot.
It's a snapshot. And there's nothing, you know, just because you wrote something out in the 2 to 7 days you had to do it on deadline doesn't mean that you'll stand by that and put it on your headstone.
No, but others will. So that's convenient.
Yeah. I mean, the line in my review that I am never allowed to forget, although I think I still stand by it, is that I compare the record to a faked orgasm at the end.
Right. And which is great.
I think I've thought about...
That makes me feel like Frosted Flakes too. That's good.
It's good. And I think that I would even say that what I like about Ultraviolence and where she went afterwards was, I think she got to a place where she found the confrontational part of that, which is saying, yeah, I was faking it the whole time. Isn't that horrifying? Isn't that the most emasculating thing that she can like say in one of her songs? I think the title track of Norman has that energy too, of, I think she's constantly on this quest to figure out like, if there are subversive things that can be done with traditional white femininity as we have defined it for a very long time in our culture. And I think occasionally, and in her, what are to me her most compelling moments, she does find a way to make that stance sort of combative and confrontational.
I also think that when she emerged, it was also like she was a little bit of like a villain. Like she bore, you know, she built this sort of portal to self-destruction and this sort of like outdated American ideals that seemed like so on their head, so incorrect that it felt correct to sort of go against her, to give her that 5.4.
I think it was a 5.5. Actually, I know, because there was a lot of...
Is it tattooed on your inner wrist?
It is, yeah. Never forget.
Wow, I honestly can't think of a better thing to go out on. Wow. this has been much more than a 5.5 episode, I would think. Thank you to Lindsay. Thank you to Mina. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Subscribe to podcasts and get your audio content, Apple, Spotify, yada, 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 yada. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com. Get on the Facebook group. Get in the Discord. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. Let's go out with a little bit of Breaking Up Slowly. So don't send me flowers like you always do. It's hard to be lonely, but it's the right thing to do.